In memory of Baby M, Baby M's mum, Jessica, is a listener and patron of Time to Talk TFMR.
This podcast is supported by ARC, Antenatal Results and Choices. ARC is the only UK nationwide charity offering non-directive, individualised information and support to parents who are making decisions around antenatal screening and diagnostic testing. They also provide specialised bereavement care for those who experience termination for medical reasons. For more information or support, please call ARC on 0207 713 7486.
Hello and welcome to Time to Talk TFMR, Termination for Medical Reasons. I'm Hayley, and today I'm speaking with two women who have had a TFMR for maternal health reasons, Rachel from the UK and Georgia from Canada. I know from speaking to many of you during Baby Loss Awareness Week about TFMR for maternal health reasons, that it can feel that your experiences aren't valued in the same way, or you're not included in the TFMR community in the same way. Let me say this right now, you belong here. We all have individual experiences, and no path is easy. They're just different. My hope with this podcast is that we can shed light on these different paths within the TFMR community and show each other empathy, compassion, and support. So with that, I'd like to welcome Rachel and Georgia.
Hi.
Hi.
It's really nice to have you both here. Thank you for joining us. So maybe what we could start with is, you know, you two maybe giving a brief sort of introduction or brief explanation of the health condition that you both had. And maybe let's start with Georgia first.
So I was diagnosed with something called a corneal pregnancy. Another term for it's an eccentric pregnancy. Mm-hmm. If you Google it, like barely anything comes up. I like deep dove on Reddit to even try to find out about it. It's seems to be extremely rare. And then I found out throughout the pregnancy, I actually also had Asherman syndrome, which is scar tissue in the uterus. So I think those two things together kind of compounded, but corneal or eccentric pregnancies are, yeah, very, very rare, but that was my diagnosis.
Yeah. And what does that mean, Georgia? What does it actually mean?
It means that my son implanted in like basically the edge of the uterus, so not the middle. Mm-hmm. And because of that, it was that as he grew, my uterus was expanding, but kind of like putting a balloon in the corner of a box and blowing it up.
Right.
It was like he was just pushing against the side, one side only of my uterus, making mm-hmm. it extremely thin. The hope was that he would move to the middle of my uterus because why not? Like it's, you know, it's a big cavernous space.
Yeah.
Like seems practical. But upon like going through the pregnancy, he never moved. And then on the ultrasounds, it actually looked like he was in a different part of my body. Mm-hmm. So they thought at 12 weeks, it was ectopic, but I knew it wasn't because I'd had early ultrasounds. And it turned out after the termination, when I had my uterus explored, he was stuck behind the scar tissue. So between the scar tissue and the wall of my uterus.
Okay.
And
that's why he couldn't move.
Pressure. No, so he could never fill up the spot. And from my understanding of corneal or eccentric pregnancies, they usually end in miscarriage mm-hmm. or the baby moving. But my son chose to just stick it out. He was definitely a fighter in that way, but there was no room for him at all. Yeah.
And so the risk there is rupture, isn't it? To you, yeah. The risk is uterine rupture. Yeah. Which is extremely, extremely dangerous and life-threatening.
Yes. And the conversation around it was very weird. So I had a lot of bleeding, went into hospital because I kept having these spots, like bouts of bleeding, check baby, fine. So we're like, that's weird. So finally my midwife was like, just go to the hospital and just like get them to check it out. And they were like, I'm not even sure this baby's in your uterus. And I was like, what? Like, but I was 12 weeks. I'm like, that seems very strange. And then they kept asking me if this was a wanted pregnancy.
Right.
And I thought that was like a very strange term.
Yes.
And I'm like, yes. And I also explained I'd had a year and a half of secondary infertility before I got pregnant with him. And I was like, this is so wanted. Like, also, I'm an adult. I'm 12 weeks pregnant. Like, I would know by now, I think, maybe.
Yeah.
But this is very, very wanted. And they kept saying, well, because it's a wanted pregnancy, you know, we'll keep looking because it's wanted. And I was very confused. Mm. And one of the doctors at one point said, you could terminate. And I said, I could, but do I have to? She said, we don't have to, but your uterus is like 1 to 2 millimeters thick. And I was like, okay, but that means nothing to me. I don't know how big a uterus is.
Yeah.
I'm just like, okay. I'm like, I felt fine. And then finally they let me out of the hospital because I wanted this pregnancy. They kept saying that to me. And I'm like, I don't know if you're telling a secret code that I don't know, because I'm not picking up on like what you're putting down. And unfortunately, the discharge notes to my obstetrician were not clear. So I was supposed to be getting weekly ultrasounds. They didn't know that. So 13 to 15 weeks, pretty fine. Go to the doctor. She eventually calls the head OB at the hospital to check in. And the OB's like, why is this girl not getting ultrasounds? Her uterus is going to rupture. I was just being kind. I was giving her time. And my OB's like, you did not tell me that. So I got rushed in for an ultrasound and they called me the next day. And they said, oh, your OB wants an appointment with you. And then they called me that like an hour before. They're like, can you make sure your partner is there? My husband. And I was like, I called my brother and I was like, you have to come take care of my daughter. I was like, they're going to tell me to terminate. I know it. And, you know, my husband, forever optimist, was like, it's probably fine. And I was like, it's not fine. They don't ask your partner to be there if it's good news. And my OB was like, I'm so sorry. Your uterus is as thick as a piece of hair. And she's like, you could rupture at any moment. So yeah, that was, but no one, if they had told me that at 12 weeks, that this wasn't going to resolve, I was going to rupture, that would have been a very different decision, because I was he was 17 weeks when I terminated because of the time it took to get the appointment. But between that time, you start showing a lot. Mm. And everyone at my work knew I was pregnant. All my friends, my neighbors, like it would have been a very different experience for me had I had to make that choice at 12 weeks. Mm. But waiting until 17 felt really cruel. Cause I was like, I'm like 11 weeks from viability. Like, can't we just push it? Can't you put like, I don't know, a shield in my uterus, like something? And they're like, no. And they said, you know, basically, yeah, the risk is death or losing your uterus. And they said, he will never make it to term with you within it. Like you'll never be able to make it. So yeah.
Okay. So there's a lot in there for us to unpick further, but I want to bring in Rachel and I want to hear, Rachel, what your diagnosis was. Yeah. And what happened for you?
I was diagnosed with preeclampsia, which had sort of, it started to kind of show quite early in the pregnancy. And I was the one who brought it up to them. They found protein in my urine and my blood pressure had always been a little bit high. And they kept saying to me, what's your normal blood pressure? And I said, I don't know. Who knows? Who takes their blood pressure every day?
Yeah, exactly.
They'd say, well, it's a little on the high side, but, you know, we'll just monitor it. And anyway, it transpired that this just kept happening and happening. So my father-in-law, who had sort of blood pressure issues, he had one of these little machines that you buy from the chemist. So he said, look, just take this home and use it whenever you feel like it. And I just started monitoring my blood pressure sort of morning, midday and evening, and just kind of tracking it on my phone and not really thinking anything of it. And then one day it just sort of started creeping up and creeping up and creeping up. And then it got by that point I knew was like quite high. It was like 160 over something. Mm. It'd never been that high before. And I felt fine. I felt absolutely fine. No symptoms at all. And I said to my husband, you know, I think we ought to call the hospital and go in. And so they just sort of said, yeah, come in and we'll monitor you. And yeah, it just kind of developed from there really. I sort of started to feel quite ill. I started throwing up, like violently throwing up, really. And I haven't had morning sickness at all. And they kept saying to me, it's probably just morning sickness.
And Rachel, how many weeks pregnant were you at this point?
21 plus. Okay. I would have been about 21 plus 5 when I went into hospital.
Okay.
So at that point, it didn't occur to me that this wasn't all going to work out fine. This was the background of the story, I suppose, this was our sixth round of IVF. So we hadn't made it past 12 weeks before. Mm. So once we kind of got to 12 weeks and then we got to 20 weeks, we just kind of naively now I understand, but you just assume you're going to bring this baby home. And so we started telling people, and obviously I'm a school teacher, and I sort of told my class, and I told everybody I work with, and we told everybody essentially, yeah, because I've been waiting so long to be able to finally do that whole big reveal. You know, we did it in all these imaginative ways, you know, videos, and I did a little, I don't think I did like a little word search with my class or something where they had to like fill in clues, and I've been waiting and waiting and waiting to announce it. So we did it in all these ridiculous imaginative ways to all these different people, because I just thought, well, I'm 20 weeks now, so
yeah, it's a given.
It's a given. I'm bringing this baby home after all these years. This is our time.
Yeah. And preeclampsia, and probably most of our listeners will know what that is, but preeclampsia is high blood pressure in pregnancy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's it, isn't it? That's what it is.
There's also protein in your urine, which kind of can be a sign that your kidneys are not functioning. So I'd already had a kidney scan by that point, and they were like, your kidneys are fine, no big deal. They put me on blood pressure medication, but after the event, it turns out that the medication they gave me was so small, it wouldn't have made any difference anyway. They didn't give me a high enough dose that it actually impacted my blood pressure at all. And bizarrely, it was me having watched medical dramas. I love a medical drama, Grey's Anatomy. And I remember seeing it on Downton Abbey, that one of the characters in Downton Abbey got preeclampsia. And that was what was in my mind when they told me, your blood pressure is a bit high and there's a bit of protein in your urine. And I was like, oh, a little memory from somewhere just popped into my head. And I said, could it be preeclampsia? And they said, oh, no, you don't get it before 20 weeks. This was at like 15 weeks, I think it was. They were like, you don't get it before 20 weeks. Like, don't worry about it. So I just went, oh, okay, because you're the medical expert. So
yeah,
you know best.
So well, I saw you nodding along to Georgia's story quite a lot, you know, because I'm hearing the similarities there about where you are being held by these medical professionals or not being held.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The feeling that I had afterwards was like, oh, why didn't I do more research into this? Why didn't I advocate for myself better? Why didn't I know more about this? But the thing that years of counseling have taught me is that it wasn't my job to know that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It wasn't my job to do the research. Yes, I could have, but ultimately I put my trust in the doctors, and the doctors were the ones who told me that it was fine. So when I went in and I started to be sick, and they were still telling me, it's just morning sickness, don't worry about it, you know, and then I couldn't move without being sick. I was just sort of lying in this hospital bed. And then the headache started. So I got this sort of intense headache, but I suffer from migraines. So I thought, mm-hmm. oh, maybe I'm having a migraine. So again, I was like, it's just a migraine and maybe it's morning sickness. And then I got the bright lights in front of my eyes. I sort of saw almost like a little cluster of fairy lights mm-hmm. up in the top corner. I remember saying to my husband, are there lights on that wall? And he said, no. And I was like, oh my God, what is happening to me? We actually got discharged from the hospital the next day. We had another appointment at a different hospital, because at our 20-week scan, my baby had been measuring small, which obviously now was due to the preeclampsia, we know that. But at the time, they said, you know, you're going for this other measurement scan at this other hospital. So they sent us home, and I was in the worst possible way. We had to stop multiple times on the way home because I kept having to be sick. And when we got home, we had always planned to go on public transport, but I just couldn't do it. I couldn't get myself well enough that I could get on a tube and get to a hospital. So we got a taxi there. I remember being sick in some poor nurse's waste paper basket when I was there, because I just couldn't stop throwing up. I had this really bad pain then under my ribs, which obviously now I know is upper gastric pain, but at the time I thought it was acid reflux, because I get that as well. So I was drinking gallons and gallons of water, trying to sort of flush what I thought was the acid back into my stomach. It didn't make me feel any better. My headache wasn't getting any better. So by the time we got back to the hospital, it just kind of spiraled from there, really. They couldn't get control of my blood pressure at all. They just kept pumping me full of medication and it wasn't going down. And then the sicker I got, the more sort of medical personnel kept coming in. They kept calling the next person and calling the next person. And eventually they kind of took us into this sort of high dependency ward. I mean, I was in the maternity ward the whole time here, so I'm listening to babies crying and, you know, mothers coming in, pregnant people everywhere. They took us into this private room where this poor couple who just had their baby, and we were sort of in the next cubicle, and they told us, we can't get control of your blood pressure. You're now suffering from what is called HELLP syndrome, which, again, I'd never heard of. My liver was failing, essentially. My blood had stopped clotting. So they were trying to give me drugs to kind of make my blood clot. My nose started bleeding. And I remember thinking, no, it's just because I've been crying so much. But actually, it was just my blood was just starting to sort of pour out of me. And they said, we've got to end this pregnancy now. This is it. We can't either you end your pregnancy or you both die. And I remember at the time, I thought they were making me choose between her and me.
Mm.
And because I was 21 plus six at this point, the day had passed, it was New Year's Eve, the fireworks going off in the background. I remember thinking, I'm two weeks away from 24 weeks. Like, you give people kidney dialysis, why can't you give me liver dialysis? I didn't know whether such a thing existed. I was just like, keep me alive, put me in a coma, do whatever you need to do, just keep me going until 24 weeks, and then this baby stands more of a chance. But obviously that wasn't a possibility. So it was just sign this paperwork. This is now. There was no time to think about it. It was like, this is what's happening. It's happening right now. You have minutes to think about it. Sign this papers and we're wheeling you into the operating theatre. I wanted to be awake. I wanted my husband to be with me. That couldn't happen. They were like, you're too sick. You can't be awake. He can't come with you. This is like a life or death situation. There's no option. And so, yeah, that was it. They wheeled me in, and when I came out, I wasn't pregnant anymore.
So I just want to take a moment there for both of you. The level of trauma that both of you have described, and the level of fear, whether what was being felt at the time, but the level of fear of being told, you know, your uterus is the thickness of a hair, or you're moments away from death. If we don't do this now, you have no time to think. Let's do it now. So, you know, as I said in the introduction about maternal health reasons and those feelings, and I think, Rachel, you've talked about this, about feeling like not a part of this community, or that because it was your health that was on the line, although I've heard what you said and it wasn't just your health, what that does to how you make sense of what's happened. I don't know if you guys would like to talk a little bit about that.
I think for me, it was like, I was very similar to Rachel. I was like, well, that's fine. If I might die, I might die, but I will stay pregnant until my body gives out. And my husband kind of had to stop me. And he was like, no, we have a beautiful living daughter. And my mom and dad were like, no, like, you can't. But I was like, you know, you're a mama bear. I was like, I'm bringing this boy into the world, and if I die, that's fine, but I want him to live.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctor had to like really explain it to me like multiple times, like that was not a possibility. And she even told me, she's like, I consulted with five other OBs. Oh, but I say OB, I mean obstetrician, because your case is so rare. And she said, we've all consents, like there's no safe way for you to continue this pregnancy. And mm-hmm. she said, there's no way your son's going to make it. And you'll be lucky if you make it at this point. And I just remember thinking, no, I'm not going to do that. Like, absolutely not. It was kind of like all of a sudden this shield came down. And then when my husband was talking, and then I had to go into the room and see my daughter, I was like, oh yeah. I was like, no, I can't do that to her.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think for me, the hardest part was them basically telling me, you're a ticking time bomb. But in Canada, we have a healthcare system similar to the NHS. So it's a public healthcare system. So it was like, you're a ticking time bomb, but we're going to have to wait till we can get an appointment for your termination. And I was like, excuse me? I was like, no, I need to go right now. Yeah. I was like, and they're like, yeah, it could rupture at work. It could rupture walking on the street, rupture in your sleep. And I was like, okay. So then I was just scared. Excuse my language. I was scared shitless for like 5 days. Yeah. Just like waiting.
5 days between five them days. Telling you that your uterine wall could rupture and getting the procedure. 5 days.
Yeah, 5 days. And I was just devastated.
So I'm sorry. So at what point is this, we're concerned about your life, but you got to wait for an appointment?
Yeah, I don't know.
And how I guess concerned like, for your life?
Yeah. And that's what I didn't get. I was like, well, if we can wait 5 days, why can't we wait a few weeks? Like,
it doesn't make any sense. Can't we see?
How did you even go to sleep at night knowing that you know, you might not wake up in the morning, or you might get up and it might happen there. Like, I just,
yeah. Well, and I was like, so I have a prescription for Ativan. It's very old. Can I take it? And they were like, yeah, sure. I was like, okay. So, and then this was the hardest part for me was because it was my second pregnancy. My son started kicking and I was feeling that, knowing that I was about to like essentially end his life. And that to me felt like the cruelest thing you could ever do to a human. I was like, this is not okay. Like, and to your point, Rachel, so much lack of communication. And so when I went in, I started at the Women's Healthcare Center, the termination. And then they're like, oh, you're actually getting it done at a different hospital. We're just starting it here. And I was like, why? And they're like, oh, you need the, because we're sending you to the place that has the best ICU, because there's a high chance you could wake up with no uterus. And I was like, excuse me, like no one had told me that. I just assumed it was run of the mill, like, and they were like, no, we need you with a better ICU, and we need you basically with the best doctors because there's a high chance you're going to rupture during the D&E. And I was like, I didn't even think about that as a possibility. And so when I went to actually get the procedure done, they gave me this form and they were like, you're going to go under, you might wake up with a hysterectomy, with uterine surgery. You might wake up in the ICU. You may wake up, not wake up for a few days. You may wake up having had a lot of blood because you could lose a ton of blood. And my husband just lost it. And I just lost it. And I was like, yeah, I'm like, okay, I thought I was doing this to save my life. I didn't know there was like still risk. And they were telling me as if they were reading off a menu. They're like, oh, this might happen and that. And I'm like,
yeah, that's so matter of fact when they tell you this stuff. And I get that that's their job and they can't get emotionally involved. But you kind of think, do you understand the people you're dealing with and the situation you're dealing with? We are talking about families and babies here. This is not kind of a broken arm situation. This is somebody's family. This is their child. You can't do it matter of factly. I get that you want to be detached. Otherwise, you'd be in floods of tears all the time. But there has to be a level of sensitivity. And it sounds like it's the same as with me in some respects. Like we both have situations where they're just like, oh, it could be this or this or this or this. It has to happen now. Sign the papers. Off you go.
And it's okay for them. Maybe it's run of the mill, like you said, Rachel, but for us, it's not.
Yeah, of course not.
It was like the hardest day of my entire life. And luckily, like when I was getting wheeled in, I was like hysterical. And the anesthesiologist was this woman. And so was the nurse was a woman. And they both said, hey, we both lost babies. Like, you're going to be okay. And they kept like rubbing my head and they were like, you know, we're with you, like, you're okay. And they were holding my hand. And I was like, the first time I'd been shown like humanity throughout the whole thing. And I was like, oh yes, people are good. Cause I'd forgotten for a minute. I was like, is everyone evil? Like, is everyone
women are good.
Yes. 100%. And luckily my D&E went totally fine. But the part that also kind of gets me, so they left, I like wheeled me in, my husband's left, he's sobbing. And they're like, excuse me, sir, you need to move. And he's like, can you give me a minute? And they're like, no, we need to clean this area. And I'm like, how untrauma informed? Come on. Like, I just feel like there was so much lack of clarity the whole time and just so much hurry up, but then wait.
Mm.
Yeah. I just felt like my feelings were not considered. And it was probably the weirdest experience. It was the strangest thing to know that you have to do this awful, horrific thing. But then part of your brain just tells you, no, actually, I'm not going to do it. I'm just going to lay here still for months. I thought I'll just lay still for months and
just fingers crossed.
Yeah. And I just can't imagine being, you know, you'd already had your 20 week scan, Rachel, like that must have been so hard. Cause I feel like to me, that's such a milestone.
Yeah. It felt like a milestone because we'd never got there before. We'd either had failed rounds or we'd miscarried. Or one time we had a blighted ovum, which is where there's pregnancy sac is there, but there's no baby. So we kind of, we'd had all these horrible disappointments and these sort of traumatic experiences, but nothing compared to this. Once we got to 20 weeks, I just assumed we were safe. Even when I see, although women now get to 20 weeks, in my head, I'm always thinking, well, I hope they don't think that they're safe. Not that I'm wishing it on them, but I just think they probably just assume they're going to get their babies. And I don't know anyone else who hasn't. Yeah. Everybody gets pregnant and they bring their babies home. But to me, I see a pregnant person and I think, oh my God, I'm so nervous for them. Like, what if something happens? What if they have their 20-week scan and they're told something's wrong? Or what if this happens to them? Or what if they're not monitoring their blood pressure and nobody's checking on them? And like, I'm now sort of aware of other people, like, and what might happen to them.
Yeah. And again, I think when we've been through this kind of trauma, we're on high alert for it in others. You know, we're on high alert for it happening. And I think that's quite a natural sort of response to the trauma that you've been through.
I don't think I was aware really of the trauma until, well, way afterwards, because I was so delirious. And, you know, by the time I got wheeled into surgery, I couldn't actually see. I only had peripheral vision. So like the front of my vision had completely gone. So I'm sort of saying goodbye to my husband and I couldn't actually see him. Like, he was aware of how serious the situation was. He knew what was going on. He was the one having the conversations with the doctors. I was kind of lying in this bed, you know, lights and headaches and pain and stuff, not really being aware that I could get wheeled in here and not come out. Mm. And he was aware of that. Like, this might be the last time I see my wife.
Yeah.
So like the trauma for him was on a totally different level. Because he thought that he was going to lose both of us. Whereas for me, I was just aware that I was losing my child.
Yeah.
But he was sort of sitting in this waiting room thinking, are they going to come and tell me that my wife has died?
Yeah.
So hard.
Yeah. Yeah. And we miss out talking about the partners, about talking about men and partners in this quite a lot. And I think even, you know, in the men that I have spoken to, they quite often feel this pull between it's my wife who's, or my girlfriend is going through this physically, you know, so then what right do I have? Because she's the one who has to go through this whole thing. And I'm so scared about what's going to happen.
Yeah.
So scared. And they're really kind of trapped in this, what do they do with this? This feeling and this emotion. And I wanted to ask you both about the sort of, did you both understand this as termination for medical reasons? No, Rachel, you're shaking your head no. So what was your...
I had never heard the term before. Nobody mentioned termination. It wasn't termination. They kept saying your baby has to be born, because my baby was born. And she was born alive. She lived for 3 hours and 21 minutes. So she, in my head, if they had used the words termination, I would have linked that to abortion, because that's where your mind goes when you hear those words. And to me, I had only ever linked abortion, again, so naive and probably part of my Catholic upbringing, with an unwanted pregnancy. Mm-hmm. Like, people who have abortions, it's because that pregnancy is unwanted. So if they had said termination to me at the time, I think I would have been horrified, because I didn't realize that was a thing that happened. I'd never heard about it ever happening to anyone I knew. I'd never read anything about it, because it's such a sort of small community that kind of lives over here in this little box, and you know, you're not part of it unless you're part of it. But I stumbled across a group on Instagram. I can't remember how. I was probably scrolling for, you know, grief support and baby loss support, and I was, you know, following all these different groups, and this group popped up called TFMR Mamas. Now,
Emma, we know Emma.
And I remember I sort of messaged her and said, I don't know if I belong in this group, because all the other groups I joined, it was people who'd had ectopic pregnancies or people who had miscarriages or people who'd had stillbirths, And when you read about a stillbirth, you think, oh my God, I can't complain then, because they've had it so much worse. They got to 40 weeks and they thought they were bringing their baby home at that point, and then their baby was stillborn. And to me, I kind of thought, I can't go in there and moan about how sad I feel, because theirs is worse. I kind of felt like I was lower down.
This is what we call the hierarchy. Yeah. And it does exist. And in my opinion, it's not very helpful.
It's absolutely not helpful, because you've all gone through a loss, and they're not comparable, really. But you do compare yourself to other people. And so I emailed Emma and I just kind of said, I don't know if I belong here. This is what happened to me. Am I part of this community? And of course she went, oh my God, of course you are. Like, that's exactly what happened to you. And as soon as she said that's what happened to you, I was like, oh my God, that makes sense. Termination for medical reasons. That's what happened to me. I had to end my pregnancy for a medical reason. Mm-hmm. But even within that community, even the phrasing of lots of TFMR groups, it's often, you know, the decision made with, you know, so much love for your baby. And mm-hmm. I kept thinking, oh my God, I wanted to do that. I wanted to make a decision with love for my baby. I tried to do that. I tried to get them to let me stay pregnant, but they made me end my pregnancy for my medical reasons. So does that mean that I don't fit into this group as well? Because I've kind of done it on an almost selfish reason, even though I didn't want to. I didn't do it to save my baby from suffering. I did it to save myself. Mm. Does that make sense?
Yes, it makes sense. Yes. in the way of the kind of how you're piecing it together. And it's what I've heard before, but I didn't do it because my baby was ill, and therefore I'm making a compassionate decision for them, a parenting decision. It was a decision to save my own life.
Yeah.
Now, I would also argue that babies need their mothers alive. Mm-hmm. Mm. That I've heard you both say, like, that's fine. I die, they live. That's fine. And I think that's, again, a very natural response. But when we think about it, actually, babies need their mothers alive.
Yeah. I'm glad my husband was more aware of what was going on, because I kept saying to him, but you'll be a father, you'll have a child. So this is what we've always wanted. You wanted to be a father and I can give you a child, but I might not be here. And he was like, what the hell are you talking about? I don't want to bring up a child if you're not here. Like, we are going to bring up a child together. And if we can't bring it up together, then that's the way it is, as horrible as that is. Like, I don't want a child if you're not here to help me bring that child up. And again, because I was sort of so off it on drugs, I was just like, don't worry, you know, everything will be fine. And I remember my mom saying, just do what they tell you to do, whatever it is they tell you to do, just listen to the doctors, just do it. And thankfully, Tom was in a place where he could make that decision, because I was like, yeah, just put me in a coma and keep me alive for as long as possible. And then whatever happens to me after that is, you know, not a big deal.
Yeah, it's what the word that's just popped in my head is incubator.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, yeah, I can see how we go into that somewhat that frame of mind, but we've almost lost our own humanity in a sense. In those moments, it's a very odd place.
Definitely. I think it's like when the mom instinct takes over, like, it's like, okay, fine. Like, that's okay. Mm. That's okay. Because all you care about is your baby. And to Rachel's point, like, I had no idea it was a termination for medical reasons either. I felt like I was being selfish. I was like, oh, I'm too scared to, like, you know, continue this pregnancy. Yeah. And my husband was like, no, they told you it's not going to, like, you're not going to come out of this with a baby. Like, you're just gonna be lucky if we come out of it with your life and with a uterus. And I'm quite young. So they were like, my doctors kept saying, you're very young. Like, as if it was better. Like, oh, you're young. So, like, it's going to be
you
fine.
You can try again. Don't worry about it.
Exactly. Yeah. You're young. And I was like, I wanted to say, like, fuck you. I'm young. I couldn't get pregnant for a year and a half. I had like my infertility was awful point in my life as well. And so I actually reached out to this woman on Instagram. She's in Canada, and it's called Mamas Matter Here. And she'd had a pregnancy loss. So.
Yeah. It's a small community. We all know each other.
So I reached out to her and I was like, as soon as I got that phone call, and then they were like, you have to wait to get your termination date. And I messaged her. I'm like, what do I do? Like, I'm panicking. Like, she was like, okay, here's some resources for terminations for medical reasons. And I was like, oh, I was like, is that me?
Yeah.
And I was very, and they gave me this Instagram page, Time to Talk TFMR. And I started listening to some of the podcasts and I was like, okay. I was like, yeah, all right. Like, I guess this is what I'm doing. I guess this is one of my choices, but it is a very, very different experience than having this thought like, yeah, I'm making a compassionate choice for my child, or because it does feel in some ways like quote unquote selfish. But then, you know, I think having some separation from it, like I realized like my mom and dad were terrified. My in-laws were terrified. Like, everyone around me was so scared something was going to happen to me. And all I cared about was my son.
Yeah.
And to your point, Rachel, like the vicarious trauma, you know, that all the people around us who are like, just do what they're telling you,
mm-hmm.
but you can't think rationally because it's not rational. This isn't like you get pregnant, you get past the first trimester, you take your baby home. Yeah. Like
this is not a choice that you should ever have to make. Like, no. Shall I choose to end my pregnancy or a baby I've wanted for so long? And, you know, we both tried so long to get. Should I choose to end this? You know, for any reason, why would you ever have to be in a situation where you would choose? It's just, it's not a choice. I know that this is a word that comes up a lot in the mm-hmm. TFMR community. It is not a choice. And no. And where it's for your own health, you almost don't really have time to choose it. The choice is made for you. It's just like, this is what's going to happen to you because it's the only option.
Yes. And I think you speak very clearly about that you have no time here. Sign the papers. Mm-hmm. So there's this really sort of complex mix of your body not being your own, your decisions not being your own, being really out of control about what's happening to your health mm-hmm. and what's happening with the people around you, whether they're doctors or nurses or whoever, and the helplessness of that situation.
Yeah.
I mean, the only other places where that kind of happens in our life, again, is in situations of life or death. You know, this is, but I think in any other situation, so say being in a massive car accident or something like that, and you're rushed into hospital and they're just doing things to save your life, you don't have any choices of that. They're just doing what they need to do to save your life. The difference here is being pregnant, there's another life involved here.
Mm-hmm.
So it complicates that process.
Afterwards, they said to me, well, you were our patient. So you were our main priority. And I was like, I didn't want to be your main priority. I wanted you to prioritize my baby. And they were like, well, you're the person whose name was on the paperwork. You're our patient. So we have to put you first. And
yeah.
I remember being absolutely furious that they couldn't understand how important she was, because it had taken us 6 years to get there and 6 rounds of IVF. And, you know, we'd never got to this point. This could have been, and turns out has been, my only chance to have a child. She was it. And I was like, you're not understanding. Like, she isn't just any old baby, which is a terrible thing to say, because obviously nobody's baby is any old baby.
So, Rachel, can we use her name?
Yes, sorry. Yes.
No, don't apologize. But I just feel like I
didn't know that she was a girl because we had chosen not to find out the sex of her. So at that time, I remember just sort of saying my baby, you know, my baby. Mm. But yeah, Georgina, she was, I just couldn't get them to understand how important she was.
Yeah,
she was our only shot. Like, you have to prioritize her. And they said, well, yeah, that's not going to happen. And I remember afterwards, because there was an independent investigation, because I'd got so sick so fast and they hadn't been able to control it and all sorts of possible errors were made. Afterwards, they kept saying to me, next time we'll monitor you more closely and next time we'll do this. And I was like, what are you talking about? There will probably never be a next time. I was 40 when I got pregnant with Georgina. So I was like, this was it for me. Like, I'll probably never be pregnant again. And even if I do get pregnant again, do you think I'm going to trust you with my next pregnancy? Mm-hmm. But the other side of that is, who else can I trust with my pregnancy? Because nobody else would know the backstory. So I have to come back here because you're the people who know how sick I could get and what happened last time so that you can make sure it doesn't happen this time. So I was kind of in a situation where I didn't really have a choice, but I did get pregnant again on our seventh round of IVF, but I had a miscarriage. So that was in the same hospital again, but that was during COVID. So my husband wasn't able to come into the appointments with me or the scans, except the very last one. I remember our bereavement midwife from our hospital. She basically just badgered everybody in the hospital and said, you cannot let this couple go through this while her husband sits in the car and she sits in the hospital. You have to let them be together because this is their loss after their TFMR. You have to do that. And just as we were saying goodbye, we were both of us crying in the car park, and I was like, you know, going in to find out whether or not we had a baby or whether or not I had actually had a miscarriage. And she came running out and said, they've said you can come in, and we both had to sort of mask up and we kind of went in together. But the hospital made all sorts of errors along the way, but I just remember being so angry that they kept saying, next time we'll do this, and next time, and we're so sorry. And I was like, well, where does that get me? Where does sorry get me? My child is gone.
So Georgina, Robin.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. We kind of picked out a boy name and a girl name. And hang on. They brought me around for the anesthetic really quickly, which, because I'd made this big thing about how I wanted to hold her skin to skin. And they said, well, you can't do that because you're going to be under general anesthetic and your husband won't be allowed in the operating room. And I was like, oh my God, who's going to look after my child? And I remember grabbing hold of this midwife. I'm still in touch with her, bless her. I sort of grabbed hold of her and I said, please, please just look after my child. Don't let anyone else touch her. Please just hold her and make sure that she gets my husband. And she did. She held her and she made sure that she only her and my husband. She sort of took her to my husband, who, bless him, had to sit there by himself and hold her.
Yeah, it's okay. Take a moment, Rachel. It's okay. You don't have to apologize.
I know. I want to get this out because... Yeah, they brought me around from the anesthetic really quickly so that we could be together, the three of us. So as soon as I was awake and my husband said, it's a girl, I just said, Georgina, because that was the name that we'd chosen for our little girl. So I didn't really give him much of a choice, I suppose. We didn't get a chance to debate whether or not it should be Georgina or another one of the names that we picked. I was just like, that was her name straight away. So, yeah. And then I had to go to intensive care. So kind of we held her until she died. And then they sort of whisked me off to intensive care. And I spent the next 2 or 3 days, I think, in intensive care while they tried to get my blood pressure under control, because the HELLP syndrome was still kind of, even though when you deliver the placenta, your body is supposed to recover, which I think it does quicker with preeclampsia. With HELLP syndrome, it takes longer because your liver has started to fail and everything is sort of going all over the place. So I was kind of hooked up to all these monitors. But I remember I was the only person who was awake in intensive care. Everybody else was under some sort of sedation or in a coma. It was so noisy because everybody else was unconscious apart from me, but all the nurses and doctors and things were just like bustling around and making lots of noise and lights on and doing this and that and the other. And I remember thinking, oh my God, how am I supposed to rest and grieve? And I kept crying all the time, and they just kept coming and pulling the curtains around me because I just kept crying. I mean, they were doing it for the nicest reason, because I was like bawling my eyes out, and they there was nothing they could say to make me feel better. So they just sort of was like, do you want me to pull the curtains? Okay, we'll just pull the curtains around. And I'd just sort of be in this little cubicle just kind of wailing away to myself. And then when I calmed down, they'd be like, open the curtains again and carry on as normal. But I don't know why I told you that. I don't know what you asked me. I can't remember what the question was.
It's okay. We were. I asked you about Georgina. It's we named her for the first time, and I wanted and you told us more, and I'm really glad that you did. And Georgia, I wanted to acknowledge your baby boy's name, Bali.
Yeah, Bali. So similar to Rachel, we didn't want to know. But when I went in for my termination, I was like, well, because I'd done the genetic testing, because I was not taking a risk. I thought I was being safe. If I did the genetic testing, I would be okay, right? Like, so naive. And so when I did my termination, my daughter had kept saying, it's a baby brother. I don't want a baby brother, like typical three-year-old. And so when I went in, I said, I'd like to know the sex of the baby. And they said it was a boy. And I lost it. Like, I knew, because my pregnancy was very different. I had a feeling. But I wasn't actually until I guess I wasn't given an option, and I'm really upset about this, to deliver. Because if I had given the option, I would have delivered him so I could have held him. But it's
please,
really
both of you, you do not have to apologize.
I just have so many regrets about not getting to hold him. So they didn't even give me an option. And honestly, I was so naive. I didn't even know women did. They told me, you're going in for a termination. It's going to be in D&E. And I was like, okay. And then after, once I joined the lost community and I'd gone to some support groups, I was like, oh, you got to hold your baby. Like, and I felt so upset that they didn't even tell me that was, and I would have done it. I don't think they would have let me, but I would have done anything to see him. And when you go in for a termination, I think this is important for people to know. They put something inside of you called Lemuria, which is like to dilate you.
Yeah. We've talked about these before. Yeah.
Yeah. I was told it wasn't going to be very painful.
Yeah.
I had been through a whole labor with my daughter. I had an emergency C-section, but I had gotten to 10 centimeters dilated. So like I had had that pain. This was excruciatingly painful. And so I had to go back to the hospital and ask for more painkillers, because I think the emotional and physical pain was like horrendous. And they wanted to put a needle into my son's heart to stop it before the termination. And I couldn't. I said, you can't. I said, I'm sorry. I will not let you do that. I said, it feels like I am like killing my son right now. Like, I can't do that. So they left the room, all the doctors, and I guess talked and came back, and they said, well, luckily you're early enough that they're going to put you under a general and he'll just fall asleep with you. And I don't even think that's true, but that's what they told me. And he'll come out and he won't feel any pain. But they were like, you have to do. And I was like, I can't. I was like, I cannot watch you. Like, I can't sit here and watch you basically take his life. I was like hysterical. I was losing my mind. And the doctors were really nice that they didn't. But I think once you reach a certain point, they do, I guess, get you to do that. And I'm lucky I didn't have to. But it wasn't until after I talked to other lost moms, I realized they got to hold their babies. And I was just really sad for me and for my husband that we didn't get to hold our son. And I just wanted him to know he was loved. And that's my biggest thing, is that, you know, because the situation was for my health, I want him to know that he was loved. It wasn't that I love me more than him, because it almost felt like that at some points. And I just hate, you know, to back Rachel up, the word choice. Like, it feels like I was like picking a dress in a shop, like, oh, what do I choose? This was not a choice.
And the thing we've said before is that it suggests, the word choice suggests that one of these options is good or preferable. Yeah. And actually all the options here are a bag of shit. It's just which bag of shit are you choosing?
Yeah. You're going to pick.
It's just, there is, it's all bad.
And it just, for me, it was really tough. Like, and then having everyone be like, oh, what happened? And I'm like, well, I couldn't carry a baby, I guess, like, was a simple way to say it. But they're like, but you, that's weird. Like, how does that happen? I'm like, I don't even know. I don't know how this happened. The doctors don't know how it happened, really. And even to this day, like, they won't give me a straight answer. Like, I saw that he was stuck behind the scar tissue when I went for my follow-up, when they put the camera up you, the hysteroscopy. I saw there was retained pregnancy tissue wrapped around my scar tissue. And so I saw that he was stuck there. And I said, did that contribute? And they said, well, we can't say for sure. So they still won't give me straight answers. And that was really hard for me because I'm like, tell me, like, just.
Yeah. There is nothing worse than not knowing the answer.
Yes.
Just tell me.
And even if you're not 100% sure, that's fine. Like, I understand that, but be honest about what probably happened. And in Canada, you have, there's quite a wait list for the fertility clinic. So I was on a wait list for 10 months for the fertility clinic. I had done some testing in September. My appointment was in December. Naively, I thought, oh, if something's wrong with me, they'll call me. Like, they're not just going to like sit with the fact that I have something wrong with me and not tell me. And so I tried to get pregnant that whole time. And I went in for my appointment December 1st at the fertility clinic. And she's like, oh, you have scar tissue in your uterus, probably why you're not getting pregnant. I was like, oh, okay. And then the next day, she's like, looking at my uterus, she's like, I want to run some blood tests. It calls me the next day. She's like, you're already pregnant. And if I had known that I had scar tissue, I would never have tried to get pregnant. Mm. And so I have a lot of feelings towards our medical system. Because I'm like, how could you have let me go 5 months, someone sitting there with this information and just being like, oh, well, but I'm actively trying to get pregnant. And then like, I feel partially to blame. I'm like, it's my fault. Like if I had waited and been more patient, but I wanted him so bad. I wanted,
yeah.
And I just assume naively that if something's wrong with you, they'll call you. I don't know.
Well, like it's like what Rachel was saying about taking on the ownership of this or taking on the responsibility when it's not.
Yeah.
It's no. Not. How are you supposed to know? You know, we go into this with good faith. We're wanting to have a family. You can't know what's going on in the inside of your body.
Mm. No.
That's why we have medical professionals.
And that's why I got to university for 7 years or whatever it
exactly,
is.
Exactly.
So we don't have to.
Exactly. So, yeah. You know, yes, there is this thing about advocating for yourself to a point, but it's not our responsibilities to know all this stuff. It isn't. That's why we didn't go to 7 years of medical school. So yeah. And again, you're saying things that I hear a lot from women, whatever their situation is, that it's a repeated thing of I should have known, or I had a feeling, or I, you know, yeah. If I had asked this question or that question, you know, maybe things have been different. Again, a really natural response when something's gone horribly wrong and grief is involved. You know, we do a lot of rumination around that. I wanted to ask you both about sort of support. I think I might know what's going to come to this because you've sort of alluded to it. So support afterwards for you both, whether that's come from things like bereavement midwives or private counseling or hospital or whatever, what's been your experiences there? Rachel, did you want to?
Actually, in terms of the mistakes that were made along the way, I cannot fault what happened to me afterwards. We were dealt with so sensitively and so carefully. We had the most lovely, caring midwives. We had to get put back on the maternity ward after I'd been in intensive care because there wasn't really anywhere else to put me. So obviously we were in this room. We could hear babies being born. It was like being tortured. But they were the loveliest, loveliest people. They could not do enough for us. Like, they made a bed for my husband to stay in so he could stay in the same room as us. They were basically sort of on call 24 hours a day if we needed something. They were so, so kind and considerate and caring. And we had this lovely bereavement midwife who kind of came, and because obviously you don't know how to arrange a funeral for a child, yeah. Because you've never had to do that before. So she kind of came and gave us paperwork and, you know, what can I do to help? And she found us a little outfit, you know, a tiny little kind of shawl thing to wrap her in. And just amazing at the hospital. Just could not fault them at all, because what else could they do? They were just so considerate, so gentle with us. And the bereavement midwife sort of kept in touch with us for quite a long time afterwards. And again, when I got pregnant in 2020, she was the first person I called. I kind of said, what shall I do? You know, I'm pregnant, I'm scared. And she was like, let me sort it all out for you. And she kind of took on our case and told me what to do and where to go and which departments to contact and things. my husband's doctor, actually, who he'd been going to since he was a child and is kind of a family friend, really. We both of us went to him. I'm not one of his patients, but we both went to him sort of in the weeks that followed after we'd been sent home and kind of said, please just help us. We don't know what we're doing. We can't function. Mm-hmm. And he referred us both for urgent NHS counselling, which we both got very, very quickly. And since then, we both had private counselling, and I sometimes sort of dip in and out of counselling. We've had counselling together. We've had counselling separately. I think as soon as this happened, we both knew that we would not be able to deal with this by ourselves. And having had counselling now, oh God, I wish we'd done it years ago. We kept going through all these traumatic experiences, failed rounds of IVF and, you know, all these horrible tests and, you know, injecting me and all sorts of things, and nobody ever offered us counselling. Nobody ever said, you might find this emotionally and psychologically damaging. You might want to find a counsellor. Like, it just, I remember one round offered me one counselling session, just one. And so I kind of went to that, and they were just like, okay, bye-bye then. But now that we both had counselling, I just recommend it to everyone, regardless of the situation that they find themselves in. I'm just like, just go find a counsellor. Like, it will help you no end. You have to find the right one. I've had about six, and I every time I'm like, oh, that one's not quite right, I'll go find another one. But I think that's the key. You have to find one that works for you and your particular situation, either someone you just want to vent to, or someone who can give you coping mechanisms, or somebody who's trained in grief counseling, or someone who's trained in baby loss, or both if possible. But yeah, I think we've been very lucky in terms of the support that we received from the hospital. And since then, obviously, it eventually tails off. People just kind of go, oh, okay, they're well again now, they're fine, we don't need to worry about them, which is another issue in itself. But I think in the immediate aftermath, yeah, we were very well looked after.
Yeah. So I actually am a counselor myself. So I love hearing you say that, Rachel. You just made my heart feel so good. I was every person needs to hear. So it was a weird experience a little bit for me, because I am a therapist. So I was like, okay, like, I feel like I should be able to handle this, which is a load of shit because I'm just a human. So the termination clinic offered me like 3 sessions. Mm-hmm. And as a therapist, I'm like, that's not going to be nearly enough to get through this trauma. Yeah. Like,
not even touching the sides.
No. And so luckily I already had my own therapist, but I really wanted to touch on the fact that when I was sitting there to get my termination, they're like, so what do you want to do with the remains? And I had not thought about that. I did not process it. And I guess before 20 weeks in Canada, at least, you can choose to have the hospital dispose of them, or you can. And I was like, you are not having my baby. I was like,
is that the terminology they use? Dispose.
Yes, dispose. Yeah. And it would be hospital waste.
That, so they've got a long way to go, because I mean, the NHS, I'm just going to say right now, my experience of this has been that for the most part, they actually say you can leave your baby's remains with us, and we will cremate them with others. And we will hold a ceremony here at the hospital for all of those babies, and you're welcome to come to that. You can plan your own cremation or burial.
Yeah, so not like that. It was like, we will dispose of the
medical waste.
Medical waste. And I was appalled. I was overwhelmed. And I was like, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to. And so I'm really lucky. I have an amazing family. So I called my big brother. As you can tell, theme, he's a big support for me. And I was like, you need to organize a funeral. You need to figure out what to do with the remains.
I love how your conversations are. You need to come and look after my daughter.
You need to do this. Like, he's a big brother, but I'm the bossy one. So I was like, I can't do this. I feel like I was going to die if I had to call and organize it. I was like, I cannot. And I'm not leaving my baby with you. Just to add to the trauma, he didn't tell me, but I got the remains a couple weeks later. They lost my son's remains for a few days, and he had to call multiple times. He had to follow up.
When you say they, do you mean the hospital? The hospital lost.
Yeah. The hospital lost my son. And my brother told me, because he's like, I wasn't going to tell you, but if you want to file a formal complaint, like, I think you should. Because it wasn't at the women's hospital I had it done. I had to have it done in a different hospital. And they were like, oh, we don't really, like, we don't do a lot of this. And I was like, just such a weird experience. And I had also asked for a last ultrasound picture and they never got me one. Luckily, I was able to get his footprints, which I got tattooed on me, and so did my husband. And then I've had a lot of therapy since then, because I took a long time off work, because obviously my job is to hold space for others. I could barely breathe. And my husband and I also do couples counseling. We've been doing it for years, especially with the infertility. That was really hard on our marriage. And then he has his own therapist as well. But like, we're also very lucky that financially we can afford that. It's not cheap.
No.
And the wait lists here are crazy. And like, I'm actually, in retrospect, I'm quite appalled that they didn't, no one called me to follow up and be like, how are you doing a few days later? Like, because I was not okay. But a lot of my friends are therapists. I have like a professional supervisor who's a therapist who is checking in on me. I have a great support system, but I'm very, very privileged. Not so many people do. So I ended up joining a pregnancy loss group, and it was in person. And that was amazing for me. It was like a 7-week group. There was a few women there who had terminations for medical reasons, a few who'd had miscarriages. And it was so nice to just have space with other women who got it, who were like, yeah, like I totally get you. And that was really, really impactful for me. And Mama Matters here, she had a meetup for lost moms a couple weeks ago I went to, and I met a lot of other lost moms. And that was really cool to like, to just get to talk about our kids, you know, like, so I could talk about Bali and hold space for him. And, but a lot of it I had to seek out myself, like nothing was given to me. And there was just this rhetoric for me, like, oh, next time you get pregnant, just let us know, like, we'll be here for you. And I was like, how could I even think about getting pregnant right now? Like, it just felt really wrong. So yeah, like I plan to, once I'm, I think, a bit more separated from it, to actually like say something to our government about it. And I actually did complain about some of my care, and I was told that women's health receives 1/10 of the funding as like basically men's health, because it's white men having issues.
Of course it is. They're the people who make the laws. So why would they prioritize us? Why would they even give us 50%?
And historically, medically, that is all medical, all pharmaceutical has been tested and done on men's bodies.
And then, white men too, right?
Yeah. And white men, but it's men's bodies, and men's bodies are held as the pinnacle of bodies.
Yes.
And women's bodies are inferior. That is the
we
message.
Are far less important.
Yeah. And I basically said, like, she's like, I'm sorry. Cause I had like, when I was hospitalized, I had a different doctor every day. She was like, yeah, like our system's broken. And I was like, well, at least you're being honest. But also, like, every human being in this world came into this world from a woman.
Yes.
We are not yet at the point where anyone else. So why don't we care? Like, why don't we care? And I just was so grateful that I had a support system. But my mom said to me, if you didn't have a support system, like, I don't know how women get through this.
No.
And I was like, I don't either. Like, I don't. And it makes me want to stand on a soapbox and yell for women's rights and,
yeah, me too,
and women's health. Yeah. And I think, you know, even for our babies, you know, I felt like my son, like I felt like Bali deserved so much more than he got. And I felt that, you know, he deserved to be cared for better. Like, he deserved to be noticed as a person. And it was very much like, well, you're the patient, like as though you're removing like a tumor. And I was like, he is a living being, and he's my son. He's a really big deal to me. And just the whole way, it felt like almost like I was being dramatic. And after meeting other women,
what a,
I realized
a hysterical
I wasn't.
Woman, are you being a hysterical, dramatic woman?
Of course I was, you know, I couldn't keep my tears in. So it's,
how dare
it's
you show emotion.
I know. Yeah, exactly. Like, why couldn't I just get through this, right?
See,
like,
this is these women always leaking from every orifice.
Yeah. But to make a serious point about that, they because this is so common, I think the men of the world just go, well, it's common, so you just have to deal with it.
And move
forward. Like, yeah, well, it's not common to me. Like, this is the one time it's happened to me that it doesn't happen to me every month, so that I'm able to get used to the emotions and the feelings of it. It's just happened to me once. this is the worst thing that has ever, and I hope to God will ever happen to me. You can't treat it like, well, baby loss is a common thing. Like, put it as a statistic. No. I'm not a statistic. I'm a human. We are humans.
And, you know, like, your daughter is a human. She was, yes. You know, she was a human, and my son's human. And it's like,
they existed in the world.
Yes.
Where they were part of the planet.
Yeah. And they're important. And yes. I just did not feel that. Yeah. And my mom ended up calling the hospital and was like, is there any more supports? And they were like, oh, like, we'll get back to you. She was like, what is wrong with the system?
Yeah,
it is just so normalized in our society in some ways, but it's like, oh, go through this, but be really quiet about it.
Yeah,
and don't make a fuss.
Do it in private. Don't tell us about it.
We don't want to know about your messy bodies.
No.
That's just a bit icky. We don't want to hear you talking about any. It's a bit gross.
Behind that door and have a cry and come out when you feel better.
Yeah. We don't want to witness any of it. No, I think that's very true. And that's kind of part of, you know, I don't want people to feel that they have to come out and share their stories to make it better for everyone else. You share your stories for you. You share your stories for you. You don't owe anyone your story.
No.
And by us talking and sharing our stories, we add a bit more nuance and be able to show these other sides.
But also when we do share our stories for ourselves, but in sharing them, it's almost like they are needed to be shared because society doesn't, you know, because society sort of shoves us behind a door. Like, no, actually, our children did matter.
Yeah.
And our stories matter.
Yeah.
Yeah, we matter. And these situations matter. You know, everybody's TFMR is different for different reasons, but you can't shut us in a box and ask us not to talk about it. It's part of life. It happens. And, you know, it took me, I think it was a year and a half maybe before I stumbled across by accident the term TFMR. Why did it take me that long? Why is it not something that is so vocal and so spoken about? Because it does happen. It's happened to us. Like, why did we have to go looking for that terminology? Why did I find it by accident while I was busy in miscarriage groups and this group and that group, thinking, oh, I don't quite fit in there. And, you know, at one point I thought I'd had a neonatal loss because my child was born alive. So I was kind of telling people that because my child was born alive, therefore she died after birth, which is true.
Yeah.
But that still isn't what actually happened. So we do have to share this so that people know that this is part of life.
It happens. And it happens quite a lot. I mean, we think there's around about 5,000 terminations for fetal abnormality per year. And then we think there's about, in the UK, which I think, well, Canada might be different because not as
we're
much
so tiny.
Population. Yeah. Well, big country, not a lot of people. But, that's the thing. And we think that for maternal health reasons, there's another 1,000 per year in the UK. So in total, 6,000 terminations for medical reasons, whether that's for fetal abnormality, whether that's for maternal health reasons, per year in the UK every year. And that's a best estimate as well, because they don't have all the numbers because these things don't get recorded. This does not get recorded.
Yeah, that just absolutely blows my mind.
Yeah. And depending on where you had, so in the UK, you may have gone to an abortion clinic if you chose surgical or you've gone to hospital. And so if you've gone to an abortion clinic, it's not necessarily going to be ticked for as termination for medical reasons. It may just get it's an abortion. So we think there's actually probably a lot more per year is what I'm trying to say, is that it's common. It's more common than stillbirth. It's more common than neonatal death. So yes, we need to be talking about it. And I'm very aware that a lot of people can't, and that's okay. Don't beat yourself up about that. It's okay. We are going to have to wrap this up because we have been talking for a long time and it's been a really, really fruitful discussion. I've really enjoyed talking to you both and listening to both of your stories and hearing more about your babies as well. But we do this little thing at the end where we call it the TFMR takeaways. And I'm going to ask each of you to give us, you know, your piece of advice or piece of hope for those who who have gone through a termination for maternal health reasons, or maybe they're listening to this because they're in that facing it. It's maybe coming to them. So, you know, Georgia, what would you say?
I would remind them that they're worthy, they're loved, and that they're important, and their baby's really important. And this is incredibly hard, but reach out for support if you can, whether it's friends, family, therapists, counselors. I found your podcast incredibly helpful when I was going through it. And, you know, reach out and know that they're not alone. There are thousands and thousands of mamas giving them a huge hug and just knowing that they're loved and so is their baby. Because I wish I had heard that.
Yeah. Thank you. And Rachel?
I think for me, in the early days, the grief was so overwhelming. I didn't feel like I would ever get past it. And I know I've cried during this, but I think for me, the thing that I could have done with hearing was that it won't always feel this terrible. The grief will always be heavy and you'll always have this pain that you carry with you, but you'll learn to carry it. It won't overwhelm you every day. It's like being drowned by waves of it. In the early days, you can't function. You can't believe the rest of the world is still functioning when this terrible thing has happened to you. You don't want to eat or sleep or speak to anyone. You just can't function. But over time, you learn to function and you learn to carry it. You never get over it, but you move forward with it. And it gets easier to carry. Not every day, but most days will be easier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you both. It's been really good. And I really appreciate it. And I know our listeners are going to really appreciate both of you sharing so openly and honestly. Yeah, we'll do it again sometime.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Thank you for listening. And we hope you enjoyed it. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. This ensures you can get all of our new episodes as soon as they're released. And you can find us on most podcasting platforms. We also love hearing from you, so find us over on social media, Facebook and Instagram at Time to Talk TFMR and Twitter at Talk TFMR. That's all for this time. Thank you, and please take gentle care of yourselves.